Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of the Midwest Hemp Council podcast. I'm Jason Dozier. I'll be your host today, and we're going to talk with Jeff Cummins. Jeff is the Associate Director for Policy Engagement with the Indiana Farm Bureau. A lot of you know Jeff. You love Jeff. He's been of great help to you, and he's going to be of help to us today. He's going to answer some questions. Let us know what's going on with the Indiana Farm Bureau and how it relates to the hemp industry. So, Jeff, how you doing today?
I'm great, Jason. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, absolutely. It's always always a pleasure having you on, Jeff, because you've always got great information that we're looking for here on the Midwest Hemp Council podcast. So let's kind of dig right in. The first thing we want to discuss with you would be some state legislation that was just handed down regarding the hemp industry.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm happy, again, to share with your viewers, you know, kind of our overall Farm Bureau agenda for this session. It was a wild one, you know, kind of the first where we were back to regular order from the 2020 session, which is to say that the House and Senate were all in the Capitol building. You may recall from 2021, we had for pandemic purposes, the House representatives met in the Government Center South, and the Senate operated in the State House for their conducting of their business. Testimony in committees was remote, so folks like myself would be in one room and we would broadcast into another for committee. And so finally we were able to dispense with that for this session. So that was one one piece of upside for us that we were back to sort of regular order at the State House this year, which was good.
Is there something about looking at the other person directly across from you that makes a difference, making that eye contact, or you know, what would kind of make the difference between the two? I understand, of course, it'd be more comfortable in the same room with everybody, but was there a huge advantage to get together as opposed to the way we were set up with COVID?
I think functionally it worked okay. I think we were still able to mostly get our points across and advocate fairly successfully. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the major challenge was just, you know, could both sides hear each other? Could you communicate questions easily back and forth? You know, the technology barriers, while I think very well administered, always have those kinds of occasional glitches that create problems. So it was really more, I think, on the technical side of, can you really have that robust conversation through a microphone, through a screen? Occasionally you can, like we're doing today, but
sure.
I think, you know, for legislative purposes, it may deter full and robust conversation. So I think that was the main thing, is getting back to in-person testimony, more in-person meetings with the legislators this session, having our own members be able to come back to the State House. So that was a big benefit as well. And we did have, I think, 160 of our members that came to the State House this year to visit with their legislators on various matters. And so that was a big piece that lacked as well. You know, it's one thing for me to go over there each day and testify and work on bills, but if they hear it from our members in their districts who made the trip and care about these issues, that's a whole different ball of wax.
Okay, and then tell us about some of the results from the finally being able to get together and look at each other in the same room.
Absolutely. Well, I think overall I would rate it a successful session for Indiana Farm Bureau. We advocated again for our home-based vendor legislation. So this is the legislation that will allow small local kind of home kitchen producers to sell their products in any venue. So before the law passed, you were restricted to the farmer's market or a roadside stand if you were doing, you know, produce or baked goods, snacks, syrups, even some meat, poultry, and rabbits. And now, let me be clear, meat, poultry, rabbits aside, for shelf-stable goods, you can sell in any venue, you can sell online, and you can deliver directly to your customer as a home-based vendor. And so we kind of reformed that statute, added some training requirements and some other sanitation requirements for home-based vendors. But, you know, these are really a small, diverse, but growing segment of our membership. And we find that the average home-based vendor is a rural female making a few thousand extra bucks a year. And so these are real small businesses, but hopefully we've opened the door to more opportunity for their shelf-stable, non-potentially hazardous goods to be sold in any venue. So very happy we got that across the finish line. The The work product of that bill was as a result of a working group from last summer, had several meetings with lots of the ag folks, beef, pork, poultry, dairy, soy and corn, as well as Purdue and the regulatory agencies on point for food safety. And so had very good conversations in the lead up to getting that bill drafted and prepared for session. So that had been a priority for us for a couple of years, and happy to have gotten that one across the finish line as well.
And to break that down, Jeff, so what you're saying is that before this bill, these roadside stands we would drive by and be able to get out and buy our tomatoes and potatoes and cabbage and things like that, we were perfectly free to do that, but we could not purchase from those same people, for instance, if they wanted to list online. They couldn't put their wares online.
That's right, and they couldn't deliver to you either. So, yeah, those products are great examples of what can now be sold. And I think of this as, you know, expanding the number of community events, fairs, festivals, parades, those kinds of things where they could set up that's not really specifically classified as a farmer's market or roadside stand. So really broaden the opportunity they have to sell and market and deliver their shelf-stable products. So,
without dwelling on it too much, because we do want to move on. What was the negative of that? Why did it take so long for something like that to be allowed?
Well, in part, you know, because we do want to remain sensitive to and cognizant of the very important food safety parameters we have in our supply chain, and so. That's how we made the decision to not expand sales opportunities for, you know, things like meat, poultry, and rabbits. Those still have to be at the roadside stand or the farmer's market. And if they are, they have to be frozen at those sites.
Okay.
And if they're sold off the farm, they have to be refrigerated. And so making sure that we're not allowing potential foodborne illness to travel far and wide if, you know, potentially hazardous products that really need strict time and temperature controls would not have those controls at these venues or being shipped to customers. And so we left some products off the table for food safety concerns. And so I think by the time we got that right, that's what paved the way for the bill.
Well, it sounds like a fair bill then. Again, as you said, you've got to be careful with the, you know, anything that does have to be temperature and that sort of thing. And that just, again, protects the consumer.
That's right. Exactly right. So a couple other things we worked on this session. Another priority was some property tax adjustments. This isn't the scale and scope of the major reforms we made in 2016, but it's some adjustments to that similar property tax formulation. One example out of the bill is we eliminated the use of neighborhood factors for agricultural properties in their assessments of property tax. So if you live in a neighborhood and people are remodeling and investing and making changes in the neighborhood, they might use those neighborhood factors to increase assessments across the whole neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Well, just because I fix my silo out in the farm part of the county doesn't mean that my neighbor 2 miles away should have an assessment increased there. And so eliminating the use of those neighborhood factors to bring that consistency and uniformity in property tax, you know, was a big piece of what we wanted to do. And so I think that's an important part of Senate Enrolled Act 119 that we worked on. Another new piece of that is an abatement for agricultural equipment if it's in a rural revitalization zone. So if a county makes a rural economic revitalization zone and a farmer would invest in equipment and things like that or upgrades, they could apply for a tax abatement. And so it's a local option and that has to be applied for, but that's new language in the tax law as well. So happy for some tax adjustments, very slight, I think tax adjustments, but important for our members as well.
You know, I just saw a meme on Facebook today, which means it's true, something about, you know, people over 65 should not have to pay property taxes. Is that something that is in the works, or was that just somebody's opinion and somebody pushing that? Is that even something that's been talked about?
You know, I've heard that from time to time, or, you know, whether it's, you know, folks over 65 or limited, you know, fixed income or veterans, those kinds of things. Those types of things are always kind of kicked around a little bit, but I don't think there's, I haven't sensed any genuine push to that effect.
Mm-hmm. Well, I imagine a lot of people over the age of 65 are homeowners, so that would be a pretty big dent in the or take a big hit from the state, I would think, in those property taxes. But
that's probably right. I'm not sure what the fiscal impact of that would be, but I'm sure it would be pretty big.
Right. And again, you know, nothing scientific about that. Just happened to see a meme, and I thought, well, that kind of makes sense. But then again, you got to have those funds coming in from somewhere. So, and again, a lot of those folks over 65 are the ones probably paying that. But at any rate, we move on. What other kind of victories did we have legislatively this year?
Well, I'll touch on a couple more and then happy to take other questions. But sure. one where we played a real heavy hand on defense was on carbon sequestration, in particular, subsurface carbon sequestration. So this gets a little complex and a little dry, mm-hmm. but I do think there's kind of an interesting piece to it here.
Sure. Go ahead.
So we had a company that had filed a bill to give themselves some civil liability protections in court when they would operate a hydrogen facility. And so they were going to manufacture hydrogen. A byproduct of that is carbon dioxide. We're going to capture the carbon dioxide and pipe it to two locations west in the western part of the state, mm-hmm. and inject the CO2 several thousand feet below into subsurface pore space. And so this is open voids, cavities, whether man-made or natural. Mm-hmm. And that pore space kind of disperses that CO2 horizontally under the ground. And so you can measure the plume as it moves out horizontally. And the plume looked like it was going to rest under about 750 parcels, privately owned parcels of ground. But because they were seeking this liability protection in the courts, nobody would have had the right to sue them for trespass or nuisance. And probably more importantly, potentially for a taking. Mm-hmm. To describe the inverse, you wouldn't allow somebody to extract coal, oil, or natural gas without first informing the landowner and paying them for it.
Sure.
Nor should you let somebody inject something under your property without the same benefit. And so we had to work pretty hard to defeat that. And I think the reason they got as much momentum as they did is it was narrow in scope, a pilot project, as they call it, limited to this one location in Vigo County. It was really to prove it out. It's a new technology that not a whole lot of companies are doing yet in the United States. And so they wanted to have this special status, this legal liability protection, mm-hmm. to prove out that they could do this. And of course, the problem for Indiana Farm Bureau and really for any landowner that would be concerned is a property rights concern that, you know, this is something now being stored in my subsurface pore space without my notification, consent, or compensation. And so we had to work pretty hard to defeat that because there was a conversation around, well, this is innovation. It's energy production. It's clean energy production. It's jobs. All probably true. We didn't ever have a problem with what the company wanted to do. We had a problem with how, and that was storing the CO2 under property owner's private property without notification, consent, or compensation. Mm-hmm. So luckily, with a lot of effort from our members, we were able to defeat that bill in the second half. It moved from the Senate to the House, but we were able to defeat that openly on the floor, 53 no votes to 43 yes votes. And successfully quashed that effort. It also helped that there was a bill moving at the same time, supported by the Manufacturers Association, BP, Countrymark, and ourselves, that allowed for subsurface CO2 sequestration the right way. And by that, I mean it required direct notification to all potentially affected parties, requires consent of more than two-thirds of those parties, and compensation to all those parties, even the ones who don't consent. And so that was the real protections for property rights we wanted to see in related to subsurface sequestration. So happy that the one bill passed, 1209 was that bill that passed and we supported, and happy that we were able to defeat 265 and 1249, which would have granted special legal protections to a company to avoid having to notify or compensate landowners. So that was a big win mm-hmm. for property rights in the state of Indiana. We were kind of on the leading edge of the blade there, but it's a big win for property rights as these projects only gain steam going forward. And we know that there are some projects that are considering this in the state. And so we know that landowners will be protected having mm-hmm. The right to pass and the bad bill die.
And this particular company that wanted to do this, obviously they went down in defeat. Does that mean that that will probably kill that project, or is there another route they can take? Other than, I guess the route they could take would be to compensate or have a vote and then compensate the homeowners.
Correct. That was kind of always our argument, that they don't need this liability protection to operate. They just merely have to negotiate with the 750 landowners under which they plan to store the CO2. They could still go do that today, but they don't want to have to do that. And that was part of the issue. And so I don't know whether it will kill their business, but if they decide they don't want to negotiate with landowners, it very well may.
Mm-hmm. And the last thing on that would be, again, as you said, this is kind of an innovative thing. Are there any other types of subsurface projects going on? Did they get this from something else that's happening, or would this been the first of its type?
The closest one to us would be in Illinois, where Archer's Daniel Midland is storing its CO2 underground as well. Their grain manufacturing processes have some CO2 byproducts, but it's all on their own property. Mm-hmm. And so they were able to get up and running without having to, there were no other landowners to involve. It's all under their own property. So that's the closest one to us. Couple more out west that we've heard of, and maybe some interest here in our own state by BP, Countrymark, or even our ethanol facilities at some point, all of whom have some CO2 emissions that they'd probably like to reduce and store those underground. So, incidentally, we're one of three locations geographically very well suited to do this, sort of the Indiana-Illinois border. The Gulf is another very porous subsurface cavernous kind of area that can hold this storage, and then out west, kind of North Dakota, that area we've heard is also quite suitable.
Well, very interesting, very interesting. So and didn't mean to dwell on that too much, but what else did we have going on? That was a very interesting story there. That was something I hadn't heard of, so kind of eye-opening.
It's certainly one of the most interesting things I've worked on, and glad we were able to get the outcome we desired. Mm-hmm. And of course, we had our annual favorite, disappointing attempt to get Kraft hemp flour legalized. We worked closely with Justin Swanson and the Midwest Hemp Council to support that. And of course, they do the yeoman's work on that, but we always testify for it and have done action alerts to our members in the past on getting support for that. So our policy book, as a general matter, is just kind of free market oriented when it comes to hemp production of all kinds. And so this fits nicely in that policy position of ours. So attempted once again and thwarted once again, unfortunately, on the Kraft hemp flower. But we'll certainly keep that on the radar to come back next year.
And do you feel like this was mostly the pushback from law enforcement that probably killed that bill? Or, you know, feel free to expand on that a little bit. Maybe some folks that are hearing about this for the first time. Of course, to us, we've been dealing with it for a couple of years here. But for folks that may be like, well, what's the deal with hemp, the Kraft hemp flower? Go ahead and give us a quick rundown and maybe, you know, why it was presented and why it was defeated.
Yeah, absolutely. So for folks unfamiliar with this, for the proponents of it, I think really like the concept because in my understanding is it's a pretty easy process, a pretty easy product to process and manufacture. You harvest the hemp, you dry it, and then you're essentially ready to sell that smokable hemp flower in by retail or those kinds of things. And so it's a cheap processing way to process hemp, and but you can retail it at a pretty high margin, and there seems to be a lot of demand. As a matter of fact, I have an aunt who owns two CBD stores, and she's always having interest and questions about Kraft hemp flower for CBD ingestion purposes, and she has followed along with the ebbs and flows of the availability of this product over time, and so always very interested in my work at the State House to know if we're going to get this done, because she has demand from her customers in the stores as well. It's just a simple way. It's another mode of ingestion for CBD products, which are very popular and growing. Mm-hmm. And so this is a cheap way to process it, get it to customers, and a pretty good return for retailers and farmers. And so that's where the proponents are coming from. The opponents say, you know, hey, when you dry and roll and smoke this craft hemp flower product, it has the same look and smell as marijuana. And so if you're conducting a roadside stop, well, suddenly we might not have probable cause to conduct an additional search of somebody we've stopped if we suspect something to be going on, because it very well could be just smokable hemp. And so we would lose probable cause, and we'll lose access to potentially detaining criminals. We tried to address that with tamper-proof packaging, requiring it not to be opened in vehicles, those kinds of things to allow for PC if somebody had an open container or was actively smoking a product in their vehicle, that the police and law enforcement would retain that probable cause based on that evidence. And even if that person had an open container of craft hemp flower or was smoking craft hemp flower, that PC would not have been diminished, because the burden would have been on the owner of that craft hemp flower, the customer who possessed it,
sure,
to retain it in that tamper-proof packaging and not to smoke it in their car. And so we had hoped to try to find, and in particular, I got to give credit, when I say we, to the Midwest Hemp Council and all the work that Justin Swanson does at the legislature, great credit to him to find these compromises to attempt to ameliorate the concerns of law enforcement, but not quite over the finish line just yet.
And we're talking about this ban just in Indiana, or is it how many other states have this ban?
That's a great question. I don't have the number right off the top of my head, but it's very few. And of course, all of our neighbors have either medical or recreational marijuana. That is to say, Ohio, Michigan, Kentucky, Illinois, and it's probably, I don't know if it's quite yet a majority of states that have something like that, but I bet it's pretty close. So the other kind of for proponents of the craft hemp flower, the other kind of frustrating piece of this is, it's allowed to pass through our state. You can't restrict interstate commerce in your state laws. And so where Illinois and Michigan and others have legalized it, or even states further out, but they might need to transport it through Indiana, that's permissible. So you can transport it. You could buy it from another state and bring it back, but you can't grow it and produce it or sell it here. And so we sort of handcuff ourselves on this particular CBD product, and most of our neighbors have not.
And to move on then, so it is legal to possess it. It's just not legal to purchase it or sell
that's right.
it or
not,
sell
not
it.
Legal to, yeah, that's right. Just not legal to manufacture, purchase, or sell in our state. But you can transport it through our state from somewhere else.
Well, maybe one day Indiana will catch up with the rest of the country.
We certainly hope so. We'll keep trying.
Well, guys like you it'll be because of people like you and Justin Swanson and the Midwest Hemp Council and Indiana Farm Bureau that make that happen. So you have our support, of course. What else did we have happen there?
I'll make a couple of mentions on wind and solar. There's a lot of interest, a lot of momentum around wind and solar development around Indiana, in particular solar. We see a lot of those. We have a lot of our members being approached about solar developments on their property. And the state legislature now kind of realizes, sort of first, as our own coal-fired power plants transition away from that, that we need more wind and solar accessible here in the state for power generation, that we've kind of, their position, I think, is we've got to try to pave the way if we can for wind and solar development in the state. Now, their attempt last year in 2021 was a statewide siting mandate. In other words, counties would have to conform to statewide setbacks, buffers, vegetation, those kinds of things for wind and solar developments. And so several groups had concerns about that, us amongst them, because we support local control on wind and solar development decisions. But they came back this year with a similar bill, same set of siting standards, but it's voluntary. And so we were supportive of that. It actually can serve, I think, as a pretty good model for counties that are interested in developing wind and solar, because it's not too onerous standards to meet for those wind and solar companies that want to come into the state. And so we supported that. Locals will retain the control on whether to have those installations in their counties, and landowners, of course, retain control over whether to have them on their properties. But it serves as kind of a guideline. I almost compare it to a broadband ready communities type of program, where if you adopt those standards, you can sort of hold yourself out as a renewable ready community. That's kind of the analogy I made during session about how it could function for those communities interested in pursuing wind and solar. So that one got through, and I think we have a lot of our members with a lot of questions on wind and solar development in the state, so we're trying to guide them through those.
Oh, interesting. And what else did we have?
You know, I think those are the highlights from session. You know, they started January 4th and and got out early. This was a year where by law they were required to be out by March 14th, and they concluded their business about 6 days early, March 8th. And so many of them, because of redistricting, have new territories in their district now, and we're eager, I think, to get back home and meet their constituents, their new constituents, if their district changed dramatically. And so they got out a little early, conducted their business, I think, efficiently, and Farm Bureau was happy with the outcome of the session for our priorities.
Well, Jeff, we certainly do appreciate the update from your perspective, you know, the Indiana Farm Bureau. And Jeff is the Associate Director for Policy Engagement. So he was the guy we wanted to get on here and you know, give us this information. So we do appreciate that. And before we let you go, is there anything else regarding the Indiana Farm Bureau, any other info you want to get out there? And, of course, always recruiting new members. So why don't you tell folks how they can become a member and, you know, any info you want to give us there about the Indiana Farm Bureau?
Absolutely. Well, I'll kind of start where we left off, because if some of your listeners are hearing more about wind and solar, or they're interested in maybe what kind of ordinances they have in their community or neighboring communities, we just helped fund a project with Purdue University for the Indiana Renewable Energy Community Planning Study and Ordinance Inventory Summary. Long name.
But, I was going to say, that's a mouthful there.
But it's essentially a report that gives you a county by county snapshot of the ordinances that are available, the ordinances that have been adopted. We have basically it's an inventory of which counties have no ordinance, which counties have a wind ordinance, which counties have solar, or which have both. And some counties you have a mix. So you might have a wind ordinance that really has such onerous setbacks and requirements that wind is essentially not permitted. Or you might have an ordinance that just says outright that wind is not permitted. So the map of the state, county by county, conducted a research study conducted by Purdue Extension and Illinois Indiana Sea Grant, Indiana Farm Bureau, and Hoosiers for Renewables, to really just kind of have a resource for communities that are interested in wind and solar. And so good, valuable resources there on which counties have what type of ordinance and what that can mean for development in your listeners' community. So that's published now. The report's all online. If you go to the Purdue University Collaborative Projects website, there's a land use tab, and you'll be able to find not only what we've done on renewable energy, but also some other studies and partners they've worked with in the past. So did want to make a shout out for that. Recently released here just in the last month or so. So we're trying to get the word out about the Renewable Energy Community Planning Study and Ordinance Inventory.
And obviously that's helping the environment. But are people saving money? Are they saving real dollars by using this solar energy and wind energy?
You know, in some cases we're hearing, in terms of the landowners, I think the income comes really maybe not necessarily on the savings to the farmer themselves, because the energy, the solar that's being sited on their ground is going to go onto the grid and maybe not be directly used on the farm.
Okay.
So the income generation is really in that per acre payment they get for allowing the solar development to be on their land. And we're hearing anything from $800 to $1,000 to $1,500 per acre for solar energy payments per acre per year for these occasionally 30-year lease deals with maybe 2 10-year options on the back end. So you could have ground in a solar lease for 50 years, and the value there is that, you know, you're still farming. You know, we're just farming a different type of energy. You know, we farm corn for ethanol. That's farming energy of a different type. And so this is kind of similar in the sense of you're still farming. And then the way they do it, they can at the end of the lease remove those panels, restore the ground, and return the land to be farmed itself. Now, you might have a little yield loss where maybe a road had to be constructed or something like that. But it's not like turning your farm into a shopping mall. And so there is some potential in the out years that if you wanted to return that land to farming, you could do it. And so really there's a lot of economic benefit on the front end for farmers and landowners, particularly if a farmer maybe wants to retire, but the kids haven't come back to the farm or don't plan to.
Right.
You can still generate income off the farm without having to sell it off if the kids don't want to come back and take up the farming enterprise themselves. So it's just another option. It's a diversification option like anything else out there for agriculture that we just want to make sure our members have the most information on.
Right. And regardless of you know, how much rain or bad weather or flooding or anything else you have, you always know there's going to be sunshine and there's going to be wind. So if you can get that guaranteed money from those companies every year, it doesn't matter if you have a flood or not. So that's certainly every benefit for the farmer. We're all for here.
That's exactly right. And we're always looking for new opportunities and new issues for them to look at. And this was something, you know, it's a transition here just a little bit, Jason. It's
sure.
There's an energy title in the farm bill that we, you know, we put together a farm bill task force to look at all the types of all the titles in there, which is the commodity title, crop insurance, energy, conservation title, and those things. So, you know, again, thinking about energy projects and what that means even at a federal level is important for our members to understand. So through that process, which we'll have the final results here in just a few weeks from Indiana Farm Bureau. But our Farm Bill Task Force looked at, I'm sure, the energy title, but also the other titles of the Farm Bill. And for those of your listeners not familiar, that bill expires every 5 years, which means its expiration date is set for 2023. Mm-hmm. So our members conducted a series of sort of listening, brainstorming, and discussion sessions to determine what our position and priorities should be for that farm bill. So we'll have that report out in a few weeks, but that took several months of really focused discussion because the bill tends to be the most consequential, one of the most consequential pieces of legislation that moves out in Congress for our members. So it's a process we conduct every 5 years to determine what our priorities need to be, and we'll be sharing that here soon with folks.
That's great, Jeff. I've certainly learned a lot in this last 30 minutes that we've been talking here, so I really appreciate that, kind of some eye-opening stuff there and letting us know what's happened. But again, the Farm Bureau is based on membership. You guys need members, always need new members. How can folks become a member of the Indiana Farm Bureau?
Absolutely. INFB.org, and you'll see a tab right on the top of our webpage that says membership. And it's got a drop-down column that says become a member. And for a mere $32.50 a year, you can become a member of Indiana Farm Bureau. And you'll see, you can look through and see the different offerings we have for members. Many of them, you know, identify the member deals we have with various companies like Ford, John Deere, Budget, and dare I say even IU. I don't know if all my Purdue farmer members know that, but there are featured partners with Indiana Farm Bureau, Great Wolf Lodge, and others that they can get some deals with as well. Another benefit, and in particular, Jason, if you've got sole proprietor, small business owner members, our Farm Bureau health plans might be of interest to them. This was something we got done through the 2020 General Assembly, a bill to give us the authority to create a health plan company and provide that as a member benefit to our members who we found were in sort of this strange income bracket where you know, oftentimes they, well, for one, many of them being sole proprietors are not in a poolable universe of employees. So they can't pool themselves as a sole proprietor for health insurance benefits. But they also were making too much money to really qualify for the subsidies associated with the Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. And so many times they were going without insurance or had some kind of faith-based plan. But another member benefit that you can read about on INFB.org is our health plan that might be of interest to some folks.
And of course, to join the Indiana Farm Bureau, you don't have to be a farmer.
That's right. That's exactly right. We have plenty of members that really, when you break it down by the farmer, agriculture members, and the insurance customers or others, you know, that's a much larger segment on the non-farmer side. Now, as we develop policy and work on state or federal legislation, it's the farmer member side that drives that. But you can certainly be a member without being a farmer.
All right. Once again, Jeff Cummins. Jeff is the Associate Director for Policy Engagement with the Indiana Farm Bureau. Jeff, like I said, it's been great having you on here. I've learned so much from you today. And before I let you go, I want to make sure I didn't cut you off. Was there anything else that we needed to discuss today?
No, I appreciate the time, Jason. It's always a pleasure to be on with you, to talk to your listeners, and to talk a little bit about what Farm Bureau works on, what we can do for others, and how we can collaborate with the Midwest Hemp Council, folks like yourself and your listeners.
All right. Well, once again, Jeff, it's always a pleasure having you on. We've had you on here about 3 or 4 times, something like that. Always great information, and that's why we always bring you back.
Great to be with you. I appreciate it.
All right. We will talk to you soon, Jeff.
Take care.
All right, and that's going to do it for this edition of the Midwest Hemp Council podcast. I'm Jason Dozier, your host. So happy to have you along with us. And again, thanks to Jeff Cummins, the Associate Director for Policy Engagement with the Indiana Farm Bureau, for sharing some of his insights, thoughts, and some great information there. So I'm going to have to go back and re-listen to that, make sure I took in everything that he had to offer there. Quite a bit of info and some great points made by Jeff. So again, that's going to do it for this edition. We certainly hope you enjoyed it, and we will talk to you on the next one. Until then, so long, everybody.